Once forged in the fires of PR and journalism, Curtis Dewar and Corey Westbrook united to create C-Squared. Now, on our podcast, we interview musicians and other industry professionals to give you an inside look on how to take your music to the next level.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the C-Squared Podcast. This is your host Curtis, my co-host Aaliyah and Gaia, and we are here with Albert, editor-in-chief of Decibel Magazine, who was with us for the second time. I think it's only the second time. But he's going to be going over some more stuff about Decibel. We're going to be talking about touring. We're going to be talking about all sorts of fun stuff. So very first thing I just want to say is thank you, Albert, for joining us.
Thank you for having me back.
Very welcome. So we're going to start the questions off with Aaliyah taking the role of ringleader as usual.
So Albert, the Decibel magazine is more than just a print magazine. Obviously, you've expanded into, you're doing web, you're doing the Metal and Beer Fest and the tour and a lot of other things. So I just wanted to ask if you have some insight and how you find a balance in what you do yourself versus what you delegate out when running a company like that?
That's a struggle. In fact, it dawned on me just the other day that occasionally that there's like so many disparate things happening at once that I have to attend to, that sometimes in the middle of the day, I literally just get up out of my seat and like walk around in a circle a couple times and just sit back down, because it just feels like I gotta do something to kind of like reset, to refocus a little bit. But that's kind of a long way of saying that it's a struggle to keep it all balanced, because we are a small company, including me. There's only five of us that are full-time that work on the magazine. And when I say work on the magazine, I mean work on everything: Metal and Beer Fest, the site, the books, the web store, the tour, everything. So it's difficult to kind of balance it, and you definitely end up having to work more than I think the regular 40-hour work week. But I can't really complain. There aren't a lot of people who get to do this as a full-time position, so. You know, it's that old blessing and a curse kind of thing. But I'm fortunate enough to have a great staff of people that I work with, a great ad sales guy in James Lewis, great art director in Mike Wahlberg, a great marketing director in Aaron Salisbury, great customer service, Patty Moran, and fulfillment. So, you know, it becomes easier to delegate things when you have a bunch of people who are all on the same page and who are as equally invested in the whole process and the whole, the whole brand, really. And I know that's, like you said, it can be a gross word depending on how you apply it to something, but I think you can, as long as the brand itself isn't gross, I think it's actually okay.
Yeah.
It is. The challenge really is, it's two things. It's finding the right people, which I've fortunately succeeded in doing, and then finding more hours in a day, which I have failed to do.
Yeah, right.
I got a quick follow-up on it. So, I mean, I know you did too. So how do you kind of manage it? Because I know you work from home as well. I find it difficult. I'm just wondering what you do.
You might hear children coming downstairs because they're still awake. It was definitely harder with COVID when they were home for like essentially a year.
Minor home.
They're home right now.
Oh yeah, school doesn't start till next week, hopefully.
Oh man, yeah, they were home almost a full month. The break got extended, not from COVID, but from snow days. So yeah, I'd forgotten what it was like to have them home like constantly, but like without schooling. That was a challenge. But I mean, I've worked from home since the end of 2008, so I don't have any. My distractions are more family oriented, really. But like for most of the, but it, you know, it's there's advantages and disadvantages. I can kind of come and go as I please at times if I need to pick them up from school, because I can do this now at 8 o'clock, or I can, after, you know, we're done here, I can log back on and get more things done that I wouldn't get done during the day. And it's a time when I actually do most of my editing because it's quieter and there aren't a bunch of emails or IMs or messages coming through constantly that need to be replied to. And I can have like concentrated blocks to actually, you know, edit and work on the magazine, which I feel like sometimes is like my part-time job at this point. You know, all the other things that seem to require more attention most of the time.
I get it too, totally, 100%. I don't think I have any more follow-ups. I think it's Gaia now.
It's me? Okay, cool. as a someone that like has been doing home, like working from home for a while, what would be like your tips for someone like that just start working from home?
I just started working from home. Oh, man. I would say, and this is just like, these are real simple things. They sound like crazy because it seems like you begin to take away all the advantages of working from home. I would say like, get up and like brush your teeth, take a shower, put on some pants, like these things that you, like some of the things that you would normally do to kind of like get in the mindset as if you had to go into the office, like in the before times, like something like that to at least try to like get you focused, at least in that kind of like, all right, now I'm in this mindset of, okay, yeah, it's time to work. Whereas I feel like if you just kind of rolled out of bed and just like kind of like you, the more it would feel like maybe you're not like signed on immediately at that point, like, oh, I guess I can read this article on ESPN, or I guess I can check this social media feed, or, you know, because I have pajamas on, I can't be time to work yet. So it's depending on your situation, you know, it could be vastly different. You could be a single person and work in an apartment and have very few distractions, or you can like, you know, have two small children who are around and like want to know like why their dad can't do certain things at a certain time, and like could be, you know, those walls and boundaries are just really a lot harder to enforce. So really, honestly, those kinds of things really depend on your situation, but those simpler things of like just kind of more routine stuff, if you could do those, cool. And then if you have other you know, if you have family concerns, then you're kind of on your own. I can't really help.
Awesome, thank you. Gonna bring you back to Aaliyah.
Okay. Yeah, I know we've talked about this on some other interviews that I've listened to, and I think there will always be a market for print magazines because there's just a subset of people that really like that, myself included. I know none of us can see the future, but where do you foresee the magazine going, or how it might change in the future?
I gotta be honest with you, I don't see it changing that much. I mean, it's been, this is the 18th year of it, and I would say for at least the past 5 or 6 years, things feel really stable and predictable, at least for us. I mean, I can't say the same of the whole industry, the whole music industry, and then more particular the underground heavy metal community. But I do think that after all this time, you know, we just sent our 209th issue to print yesterday. So with that kind of history at that point, you don't take anything for granted, but you, at the same time, you reach the point where you're maybe a part of the furniture in a way. And you kind of, people know what, I feel like our audience isn't going to just like get up and disappear overnight unless we do something drastically stupid, which I guess I can't guarantee that part won't happen. But like, I don't think our audience is going away. I think that things obviously get harder for record labels. There are ebbs and flows in that, even in terms of like sales, whether it's streaming or physical mediums, which have before the production crisis that's kind of going on now, that had been like trending in a really positive direction. So I think that there's going to be a way for that to kind of balance out. And I don't want to say that things are like, I don't want to sound like they're predictable, but they just feel stable in that sense, you know? And I've probably said this before too, but we're a niche magazine. So what we're aiming for, we're not aiming for like some crazy high circulation number. We're looking at we kind of know what our audience is. We kind of know where the ceiling is, and I don't feel like we're reaching beyond it to try to grow it in a way that might confuse people. Like, you know, like why would you need to be in train stations when you've got like Imperial Triumphant on your magazine cover? You know, like you can't act like some things are bigger than they are, but you also don't need to act like there isn't an interest in these artists that we're putting out there and this audience that we're serving. So I think that the bottom line is, in terms of the print magazine, is I think we've been realistic about it for a long time, but not fatalistic about it. And I think that's the difference. Like, I don't look at it and like, I don't think the sky is falling, because all of the evidence of 18 years of what we've accomplished and the way that we've organically grown, kind of, I guess it's proof of concept, you know?
Yeah.
I have a follow up.
Okay. I have a follow up too.
Oh, I go first, Leah? Is it okay?
Yeah, sure.
Cool. I don't remember if I asked you this last time, Albert, or I might have even asked you on an earlier podcast I had, but I don't recall what you said on this, but why do you think Decibel is still going in magazines like Terrorizer, who were around for a lot longer than you guys folded up?
I don't know. I mean, well, there's a couple things, I guess. I mean, we've been fortunate enough to have different revenue streams that Terrorizer didn't really have. Terrorizer really never developed anything beyond the traditional kind of print advertising base and then their subscriber base. And yeah. I don't know what they sold subscriptions for. Like, I don't, like, for us, subscriptions need to be a source of revenue. They can't, we don't do like the, what magazine was that? Like Outburn with like the $10 annual. Yeah. Or something, because we weren't courting massive corporations to spend a ton of money to wow them with a high circulation or a high subscriber base. Like, that was never looked at it like that. It was always like, well, no, there's a, like, we don't need to devalue the product because there is this sizable core of people who value this product and they've assigned value to it. So if they find it valuable, they'll be willing to pay for it, and that can be a source of revenue. Advertising, print, and then print advertising is a source of revenue. So I know I can't say that Terrorizer had that same philosophy. Maybe they did, but I do know they didn't do live events, they didn't do books. I don't think their website was really something that was much of anything other than an afterthought.
Yeah.
So like right there, those are, like, and obviously we have a pretty robust web store at this point with the things that we carry, in addition to, you know, like limited records that we help produce and things like that. So I think for an example, for something like Terrorizer, I mean, and I also think, you know, not to throw anybody under the bus, but I think it was poorly managed for a long time on top of that.
Like, yeah.
You know, and, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's like you know, we've been around a long time, and there's, you're going to make certain people unhappy eventually, but I don't think you'll ever hear like freelance writers really talk shit on us, because we've, you know, we pay people, we don't leave them hanging. We're pretty responsible with making sure things get out on time. And if for some reason things are slow, we get in front of it and let people know, hey, you know, you don't have to knock on our door like on the first. If the check isn't there, it'll be there on the second because this thing is going on, or our bookkeeper's been out sick for a week or whatever it is. We don't have anything but like a really good reputation with that stuff. But which is why I don't feel bad about saying that Terrorizer was poorly run at the end, because that reputation did not exist for a while there. But yeah, I mean, obviously the revenue streams is a huge advantage. And you know, maybe with something like Terrorizer in particular, maybe their brand was kind of limiting. It was, yeah. Obviously we're a niche, but our name isn't Terrorizer and our logo wasn't Terrorizer's logo. Yeah. So I think like, you know, maybe we saved ourselves some of that struggle early on by kind of deciding that, even though the core of what we do and the actual content that we produce would still be catering to extreme metal, the look of what we did didn't have to be overtly extreme metal or overtly underground metal and scare away some people who might, some advertisers or some marketing people who wanted to dip their toe in metal in a safe way or something like that. So we kind of left that door open, whereas I don't think a Terrorizer or even a Metal Maniacs had that advantage.
Fair. I think I've done my follow-up with you.
Yeah, it's actually something that I've heard advised for anybody freelancing, is to have multiple revenue streams. So it's interesting how you've implemented that with your company.
It's the same community, and it's the same, like, we all have that kind of same struggle. There isn't, well, obviously, you know, that like somebody like Nuclear Blast has a distinct advantage over you or me. Like, it, we're still all kind of in that, we're all still in that fighting for that same piece, really. So for us to have the same approaches as anybody else, I think isn't super surprising. But sorry, I cut you off. Please go ahead.
No, please. It's good. It's all good. You had mentioned though that things have changed a lot for record labels, but not so much for you. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on like the fundamental differences between the two that might explain why things have been so stable for a music magazine versus a record label.
I mean, I'd say you can't stream a music magazine, but I guess blogs were supposed to be the music magazine you can stream. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the stuff that we do, the content that we produce, and I feel like the way that we present it, I don't think there's another way to get it other than through the print magazine. While, yeah, you can get the occasional think piece or the occasional spicy op-ed online. And obviously you can get news, like just like clickbaity metal news about the guy from whatever shitty band who doesn't believe in COVID, you know, like whatever is going to like get something moving. And where we don't do that, or we can't provide that, or we don't have an interest in doing so. I guess what I would say is like people were able to replicate the listening experience of buying a record without a record label. They were able to go to Bandcamp and stream things. They were able to go to YouTube and watch or listen to songs. Whereas I don't think that the content that we're presenting, that there was a way to replicate it without buying the magazine. You know, like there weren't people who were doing 6,000 word articles on classic records where they were interviewing everybody who played on them and played on those records and trying to provide context for it. That wasn't that wasn't something that you would just kind of find on the web. And if you did, you weren't going to find it really in the metal scene or the metal community. So I think that maybe it's just that the service that we were providing, nobody else was really providing it. Whereas the listening experience for some people, for them, it wasn't any different from digitally listening to files on a CD than digitally streaming them from their computer. So I think that until some record labels really kind of got a sense that they did have an advantage where they could produce some of these physical goods and tailor them in a way that made either some older listeners nostalgic to acquire the format or pique the interest of a generation who maybe missed it the first time and wanted to get in on that experience. I think it wasn't really until then that the idea of physical became something that actually had value to the record labels again.
Yeah. Gaia, do you have a question?
I'm actually stealing your question, I think is what it was, because we had decided to switch, I think. But actually, no, this is Gaia's question next. Sorry, Gaia, I cut you off. Number three.
Okay, well, sorry. where do you see the magazine going and changing the future?
The print magazine itself, just the magazine.
Magazine.
I don't know. I mean, I want to, it's been tough with everything. Everything as far as the pandemic is concerned, and kind of projecting the bottom line is the magazine is largely beholden to a record release schedule. That's the main thing that we kind of base our content and coverage around. And when that has kind of been thrown into flux for really 2 years since the start of the pandemic, when you had that period of about, I'd say, 6 months when labels just started pulling their releases that they had planned for the spring and summer and kicking them to what they had hoped would be the fall of 2020. And that not too long after that kind of leading to this production crisis with vinyl and now kind of catching up with tapes and CDs. It gets harder and harder to kind of like nail the line up the coverage with the release dates when the release dates feel like that they're always this moving target. Mm-hmm. So normally you kind of have that in place where you know a release schedule and you work around that, and then you can kind of fill in the gaps with maybe some more interesting kind of special issues, or maybe this is a trend piece that's kind of a cover story like we did around this time last year when we did our cover story on what it was like for a year without live music in the metal community. And that became a cover story. It's like a cover with literally nobody on the cover. Like I really like to do things like that, that kind of step out of the, here's another band, and be able to either kind of to do more things like that or to do themed issues that are really based around sometimes loose concepts, sometimes really tight concepts. Like there's been one that we've been kicking around for almost 2 years, and I've been trying to find the right window to make it happen. And then the always changing release schedule has not been cooperative to kind of nail a spot down for that. But I mean, one thing I would like to do is just kind of continue to keep the content interesting and kind of continue to keep people on their toes and guessing to what's coming. I mean, every once in a while, you want to, like, you don't want to mess around. If there's a new Metallica album coming, you should probably put Metallica on the cover. If you can think of a cool way to present them as a cover star in 2022 or whatever year it is. But I do think, you know, like I said, I feel like the magazine itself its place is a little more solidified and predictable. So for me, it turns into, all right, how do I keep it interesting, but also maintain the core values that our subscriber base and our readers are going to be interested in, but also kind of keep it interesting and fun for me, because I don't feel like I'm burnt out yet. And the truth is, if I get burnt out on anything, it's probably not going to be the magazine part of this job. So like just trying to keep that fun and interesting too.
That's awesome.
So I kind of got a mini follow-up sort of different question at the same time. So what do you think the advantages are of being in print Decibel versus online Decibel, or do you not see a difference? Or
I think that for me, the big difference is that online is just a constant reaction and race. Online Fair. Is always this, oh, this press release went out, just regurgitate this and get it up and share it on your socials so it gets passed around and you get your clicks. Or this story broke about this horrible thing this person did. Somebody reported it, so report that they're reporting it, but you don't have any time to actually follow up and talk to people and vet sources or do anything that was typically something that you would typically see in terms of traditional journalism. Even this whole thing that happened within the past couple of weeks with the woman, the ex-bassist of Coal Chamber.
Mm. Oh,
it was reported that she was missing, and the report seemed to just stem from some law enforcement Facebook post from September of last year. Mm-hmm. And that got shared, that got posted somewhere, and then it got shared on every single metal media site. Well, not every single one. Well, there's one that didn't bother with that. But the bottom line being that just got passed around, and it was really the only reason that story got followed up on so quickly was because it was her daughter, I believe, that was she's not missing. I know where she is. I just talked to her. And that the whole thing was just so weird and so symptomatic of that world of this is the hot thing. Just share it. Just post it. No, it's cool because this other site posted it, so it must be fine. There isn't any more work to do other than to regurgitate this and push this out. And I think when you're in print, you have a minute to catch your breath, because you're not you're not fighting to be first on something. You're not fighting to break some kind of story. You can actually break stories, but it's investigative journalism if that's something that you want to do. And to me, that's just way more rewarding and interesting. And I think those are pieces that maybe will stick longer when people can read something that is more fleshed out like that. But it just to do it any other way also just feels irresponsible, and would just as that ex-Coal Chamber member as an example, I think is a pretty strong case against doing things like that.
Agreed. Now, question for you though. So if that's what gets the clicks though and gets the advertisers, have you never thought about kind of going into that direction? Won't do it no matter how much money is in there?
I don't want to do it. It's not something that interests me. Even if it did interest me, I wouldn't have the time. I can barely get three or four stories up a day on the Decibel site. Fair. Versus the fucking brutal churn that it must be to get 15 of those stories that you see on Metal Injection and Metal Sucks and Loudwire constantly.
Yeah.
And I mean, who the hell has time to check up on what Dave Grohl's doing every 20 minutes anyway? But
they do.
Yeah. But the bottom line really is that I don't feel like we have to do that. I don't want to get into that game. And when I see it, it really, all those sites just kind of reinterpret the same story over and over again. I mean, you can go look at Metal Injection and Metal Sucks, and it's like you could just like pull up two windows side by side and like scroll down, and it's like just the same story, like each time with a slightly different headline back to back. And I'm just like, I don't care how much money is out there. And I mean, I don't think there's that much, actually. I think that they're like really kind of really fighting each other for all those pennies that are out there. And if that's what they need to do, fine. I'm not condemning them. I just don't want to do it.
Fair enough. Yeah. Aaliyah?
Now, when thinking about Decibel's website and your print magazine, you do feature different bands on your website versus in your magazine, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, there's definitely crossover, but there are a number of bands that get in the site, or that get on the site that you don't see in the magazine, and vice versa.
So what are the differences that you look for to decide whether you're going to put a band in the print magazine versus online?
I think that the online site always feels like more experimental and more, I think it's more open. There's like maybe a little less vetting in the process, where it's like, as long as something isn't overtly awful and isn't something that's like is just like objectionable and unconscionable on just like a human level, there you can make an argument and find a case, or make a case for it to do something with it online, because mm-hmm. I think that it becomes really helpful for some of those younger bands too that wouldn't necessarily be able to crack Decibel. Maybe they wouldn't get a full page, maybe it would be really not even appropriate to review them because maybe it's only an EP that they released. But if you stream their EP on the site, it's going to get it out in front of people. I mean, the website is largely driven by track premieres. There is other content that gets mixed in there, but that's what pushes it along during the day. You could like, I mean, if you went to the site now, you might see like the last six or seven posts were just all track premieres or video premieres or full album stream. So I think that having that be a tool for artists to use in a way, I mean, yeah, we do have to vet some things, obviously. We're not just going to put everything that everybody requests on there. So there has to be some quality control, but there's definitely more a sense of, I think, just like general weird discovery that you can get through the site. And I like it that way because, I mean, there are a number of contributors who post that I just like leave it up to them to like just fill your spot at this time on this day. And then I'll go to the site and I'll be like, oh, what is this? This is pretty cool. I'm, you know, and then I'll listen to the record. I mean, I have discovered bands through the Decibel site that I had no idea were going to be premiering at the time. And if I'm doing that, I'm sure there are plenty of other people that are having that experience as well. So I just like that to be kind of a more accessible for any kind of band at any kind of level, where the magazine might be a little more, I don't want to say elite, but a little bit of a tougher nut to crack.
Yeah.
So Curtis? I just wanted, there's two things I want to say. Number one, we're running short on time. We've got about 10 minutes and we got a lot of questions left. So
we don't have to ask all of them.
Lightning round.
Yeah. I'm just letting you know to pick and choose which ones you want to do now. That was all I wanted to say.
Well, sure. Does Guy want to ask a question?
I do actually, because you guys are like, you have your festival. And I was wondering, would you have any advice to give to any person or any band that are like planning to do a tour, or like planning to have like a mini tour? What kind of advice would you give them?
Get vaccinated. and if you're doing a tour, wait till maybe March if you haven't booked it already. We don't we're not in that position. For us, we have the Decibel Tour starts at the end of January, a less than fortuitous time to roll out a tour right now. But my advice would be, if you are going out on the road, to just be as safe and responsible. And I mean, you can do all the work, you can observe all the protocols, you could be on your best behavior, and you could still get sick out there. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard right now. It is a rough time to be a touring musician, or a musician who makes a living or a significant portion of their living off of touring. It's rough. I feel like I have this weird push and pull where you think to yourself, is it irresponsible to even send this tour out in January? But there are these artists who have been booked on it, and they have families, and this is how they're gonna, you know, this is how they are gonna, like, you know, like pay their mortgages, because they have these guarantees coming from these shows. So it's just like, it's a really weird and rough time right now. So I know it's like, I'm sure that was probably a more general question about, like, what advice would you give for, like, booking or picking a city or a venue or a room? But I feel like when anyone is, like, anybody who works in live events right now, the first thing that you're thinking of when somebody talks about it is just COVID and how it relates to working through that. So, I mean, my advice would be, you know, again, like, if you can hold off until things calm down a little bit, like I think they actually might in a month from now, please, you know, do it if you can. If you have to go out on the road, or you have your festival going down, I know the MDF guys have California Death Fest happening at the end of this month, and that's going to be the first thing they've done since like over 2 years. So, you just try to get through it. We were really lucky in 2021. We had two fests. We did them both, and everybody came. There were no outbreaks as far as we know. Nobody contacted us to let us know that, you know, there were. We're really lucky. We got to get them off, and people had a good experience. And I'm just hoping that things can kind of hold where everybody can do that eventually in 2022 as well.
I have a quick question, because I actually don't know, because here up in Canada, basically everything stopped because we're pretty much on lockdown again. Is the regulation still pretty strict up down there?
I mean, it's strict, but it America is, and this goes without saying, a very weird place, but sure. It varies so much from state to state and municipality to municipality, that there's never been a cohesive national response to COVID. It's always been, you know, just localized areas and states. So there hasn't been, no state has shut anything down. The country certainly hasn't shut anything down. So you can tour. There's bands out on the road touring now. There's shows happening tonight. There are restaurants open, there are bars open, everybody,
you know, I'm so jealous right now.
I mean, and like, there, the argument is pretty strong to avoid those places if you can, or, you know, be outdoors if you can, and hang out, find a very good heater and stand next to it and drink a beer. Nothing is locked down, and I really don't know what it would take to send America back into a lockdown like we saw from essentially March of 2020 through really the spring of 2021.
Yeah, we never really ended over here, so I was just curious. I wasn't trying to get like political thing like that. I was just honestly curious what was going on with that. But Aaliyah, I'll let you take control again before we get into politics.
Well, considering all of the risks associated with physical touring, as you know, and have participated in online streams for concerts have become much more common thing. What are your feelings on that? Do you intend to continue hosting them?
My feelings, they evolve on it. When they first started, which was probably like, I would guess they would probably be in around spring or summer of 2020, a couple months into the lockdown, I absolutely hated them. I couldn't bear to watch them. They just depressed me. It was this like weird substitute for what I was missing, and it didn't work. It was like the worst non-alcoholic beer imaginable. Like, you're like, oh wait, this isn't what I wanted to be, and I just don't want to have any of it if this is my option. But I think as time went on, I was able to begin to not think of it in terms of what it wasn't, but what it was, and how you could make that format interesting and how you decided to approach it. So for us, you know, we obviously had the tour and the festivals, which the tour which we had to cancel in 2020, and the festivals which we had to postpone until 2021. But we did have our 200th issue coming up in early 2021, and I knew that the world wasn't ready to have a like event in April of 2021 when our 200th issue was scheduled. But I didn't want that milestone to go by without it being acknowledged. So I managed to kind of pull that together. I don't want to say fairly quickly. We did it over several months and got a bunch of bands involved, and it seemed like a really fun way for people to connect, because we got so many people involved in it, like just outside of bands, to kind of like drop in as guests to celebrate the magazine and that milestone. And then as we broadcasted it, there was just like so many people interacting online, and it was like, it was weird. It were people who like wrote me who were genuinely moved by it, because it was this experience that they felt was like, it was obviously different than going to a show, but they felt like the community of the people who would be at a Decibel show, or the people who would be at a metal show, like through this Decibel show. So I don't know how you recapture that. That may have just been a moment that we had that I don't know if we can ever really duplicate it, but I'm not averse to doing stuff in the future, and I think there'll be a place for it. And I mean, depending how this next strain goes, I expect things to kind of calm down and like things to level out a little bit, but I do see this as kind of a constant like plane we're going to be on for the foreseeable future. So I do think that while those have kind of quieted down a little bit, I think you'll see them like kind of creeping back.
Cool. So we've got time for one more question, Aaliyah, if you want to throw one more in or not.
I think that wraps things up pretty nicely. Cool. Guy, do you have another question?
I have a new special question to end.
Okay. Gaia has the last question.
Okay. So the important question. What's your favorite shark?
My favorite shark. What is it called? A goblin shark.
And I only... Oh my God, it's my favorite too.
Yeah, and I only found out about it very recently through my 7-year-old son, who was taken like when they were home. When they were home for Christmas break, their Christmas break got extended because of snow. So my wife and I were looking for like online classes to kind of keep them interested. And my wife found this one on goblin sharks, and my son was just like, oh, I'll take that one. And then he took like a, you know, half hour online class about goblin sharks just as like a week ago. So but they were so crazy and weird and like, that it stuck with me. So yeah, goblin shark, there you go.
It's a very good answer.
I just looked those things up. Those things are crazy looking.
Yeah. You can see like something like out of a nightmare. Like it's, yeah. They look insane. Yeah. That's why I like them.
I'm surprised there isn't like some like synth band called Goblin Shark yet, but I'm sure it's I'm sure Curtis will be sending me a promo for it. Like,
yeah, probably.
And Club Solve Goblin Shark. Just, like, make sure I send it to you, Albert. We have anything else?
No, let's just keep swimming. And until next time, everyone, make like a bull and throw those horns up.
Cool.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please help spread the word by leaving us a 5-star review on your platform of choice. You can also join the conversation by following us on any social media and suggesting guests or topics you'd like to learn more about. Thanks for listening to C Squared.